Hello, everyone, and welcome back to The Translator. My name is Julie Mouchin, and this is a podcast brought to you by Risk Pro, where wealth tech and reg tech converge. It's July 2020, and it's been quite a year so far with a new way of going about life every day, wearing a mask, social distancing. I would like to take a moment to say that my thoughts and prayers are with any of you that have been infected or have a loved one that has been infected by COVID-19. It's a dangerous virus, and we hope to get this behind us. I think we're doing very well as a country, you know, coming together or staying apart at the same time. I'm also thinking daily about our young republic that is experiencing social unrest and violence. Watch out for episode number 5 to drop later this month, where I interview my first millennial guest. So for all of you boomers out there, if you want to hear what a millennial thinks, tune into that one and look for it close to the end of this month. It's called Ginger the Millennial. Anyway, I want you to not just hear from every demographic on my podcast, but actually listen to the stories from everyone's perspective, one that you might not have a chance to experience on your own. After all, we are called the translator. Okay, let's get to this episode, though, which is number 4, and I'm super psyched for it because it's nearly impossible to get my guests to stay in one place for more than 10 minutes unless he's strictly talking business, and I want to go way beyond that. So who knows how long and where this thing will go, because I have none other than Nick Scalzo in the hot seat today. I've personally known Nick for almost 5 years, I believe, and he's probably one of the most intense people I've ever known or gotten to know. As I think back to when I first met him, he was like that the very first time I met him. He's not slowed down for one second or become any less intense than that day. He is literally going full tilt at all times. Many people know Nick as either the co-CEO with Megan Mead of Pro Tools and the Pacific Financial Group, or you could know him for his charity work that he's done annually, or maybe you know him from the RIA that he and his brother started back in California years ago, or even as a drummer for a Southern California punk band. Wearing many different hats is not a problem for this guy, one which is a high hat. Maybe it's a Zildjian. We'll have to remember to ask him that. So because we're already short on time and I want to cover a lot of stuff, let's get Nick out here. And I'll first ask him about the revolutionary technology of Risk Pro. And then I'm going to try and go out there into his past, what he's passionate about. We're going to talk some music. Hopefully we'll just see how far we get on this one, folks. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Welcome to The Translator, Nick Scalzo.
Hello.
Thanks for being here, Nick.
Thanks for having me. It's good to sit down and talk to you. We need to get more time together.
Yeah, absolutely. Hopefully we'll be able to get to see each other again soon. You know, you've been stuck on the East Coast. I've been stuck on the West Coast. Wait, I said that backwards. I'm stuck on the East Coast. You're stuck on the West Coast. Whoa, dyslexia for cure found. Anyway, let's start simply with, take us way back to when Risk Pro was first thought of, how it came about, you know, take us way back.
Yeah, Risk Pro really kind of came about at the convergence of two separate things. First of all, we had a multi-manager turnkey asset management platform in 2006, 2007, we were early movers in the liquid alternative space.
All right. So you had a turnkey asset management platform. And for those of you listening that don't know what that is, it's often referred to as a TAMP, T-A-M-P, the acronym for it. And what you can do with that is you can have a lot of managers sitting on that platform for advisors to use and build portfolios with for their clients. What was the name of the TAMP, Nick?
Market Movement Solutions, or MMS, was the name of the TAMP. Elements was the name of the company. And we had probably 40 or 50 model portfolios on the platform. And several of those were liquid alternatives. As I said, we were early movers in that space. Then we got hit by the Great Recession coming out of 2008. Everybody, I'm talking about financial advisors, started really adopting and unfortunately sort of experimenting with the liquid alternatives models without a deep knowledge of what they could do to a portfolio and how they actually work. We had a ton of educational pieces, but we started seeing them rebalance their portfolios or bring in new accounts that had outsized allocations to these liquid alternative models. That prompted my then current chief investment officer, Josh Emanuel, who is actually now Wilshire Associates chief investment officer. He came into my office and he said, listen, we've got some liability here because we, the Elements Group, is the discretionary advisor to the client. We had the fiduciary liability, except that they got to use our risk profiling questionnaires and then pick a variety of models in a unified managed account.
So the Elements Group held full fiduciary liability, and the advisors that were utilizing the TAMP were solicitors, right?
That is correct.
So that they would build portfolios and you actually had the fiduciary responsibility to make sure that those portfolios were suitable for the client.
Yeah. So they kind of assembled the portfolios together. And we were getting really concerned around the way they were assembling these models together.
And it was putting you and them at risk and possibly their client.
That is correct. And the chief investment officer said that he wanted to give the financial advisors direct access to himself, our CIO. And I replied, well, how are you going to scale that? He said, come into my office. I want to show you. I've already built it. And this is very early on, okay? There were none of these digital risk systems out there or anything. And he showed me that he had built a spreadsheet that had our entire product shelf on it and that he could assemble in about, I mean, as quick as 15 seconds, any combination of portfolios to target an outcome, and demoed it for me and nailed it. They nailed the beta, the standard deviation, everything.
Let me ask you a question. He had a spreadsheet, like a Excel spreadsheet.
In Excel, yes.
With a mathematical algorithm.
Yeah.
That did what? It measured when he would put investments together. What was the outcome?
Yeah. He would either, in those days, he would either target a beta to the S&P, he would target a standard deviation, or he would target a dollar loss threshold.
Aha. Uh-huh.
Okay. So he would say, I have $1 million account. I never want to see it go below 800,000. So that's a $200,000 loss threshold. And it would calculate his beta, his standard deviation, et cetera. And then he would go to the product shelf, drop in one or more of our model portfolios, hit calculate, and it would give him his results. And if he was a little bit off, he would, you know,
he would adjust.
He would adjust and then nail it. And he nailed it to the penny. And I was like, wow, that's impressive. So that's going on sort of in your left hand. In your right hand, I think it's important to remember that my brother and I own a client-facing RIA, Claremont Financial. So I still give client reviews to this day, Julie. And at about that same time, I have these clients that are very dear to me. They're still clients today. They had moved to Hawaii from Claremont, where our office was located, Claremont, California. And they were really staunch Republicans and thought erroneously that whenever a Democratic president's in, you're not going to make any money in the markets.
Yeah.
Plus, they had gone through 2008 and the Great Recession. And they called me in February of 2009 in a bit of a panic that the stock market was on its way to zero. And they forced me to take them out of, let's call it a moderate risk portfolio, and take them down to almost zero standard deviation. I mean, they were one step above cash.
So the political atmosphere was causing them to think irrationally because they were emotional.
I think going in, it was emotional that they were going to lose their retirement and the markets were unstoppable on their way to zero. Because remember, in February of 2009, it looked pretty bleak. And by the way, it should be noted that we give quarterly reviews to all advisory accounts, regardless of how big they are, because we think money's relative, right? No matter how much you have, that's all the money in the world to you.
That's super cool. I love that.
Yeah, that's kind of our philosophy. And so these people actually had a lot of money. And I was giving them quarterly reviews, and I was gently trying to coax them into taking on more risk in the portfolio, that the clouds had passed and it was time to come back out into the sun. They rejected that at every turn. And Julie, no matter how hard I tried, and that was four times a year for several years, they would not add risk to the portfolio. And then came the fateful day. And I'll never forget it. It was within 24 hours of, you know, the CNBCs of the world displaying with cheers that the markets had now reached a new all-time high. And the phone rang within 24 hours, questioning why we missed it.
Why you missed the uptick, why you couldn't call the bottom. I know every advisor in the financial industry that's out there listening to this has been in a situation, if not exactly the same, very, very similar, especially if you lived through a market like 2008 or 2011, where, you know, investor behavior of fear and greed, it's human nature. So it's really tough when you're going through it, right?
By the way, I've lived this one because, you know, with over a 30-year career, there's been several ups and downs, right? So I've lived it a lot. But this was the last time I was going to live this one. Because interestingly, while I love these people, it blew me away that within 24 hours of seeing that the markets had made a new all-time high, I'm getting the call asking, how come we didn't participate in the rebound? So we got past that, but I went in to really sort of vent to my chief investment officer, and I sat down and said, you're not going to believe this. Well, right at that moment, he actually had that spreadsheet I told you about on his computer, and he was working on it. And so he had kind of one ear on me, you know, just let me vent. I don't even know if he was paying attention. And I had an eye on his spreadsheet as I'm venting, and I looked and I said, that needs to be on every advisor's desktop. You know, because I, as I said earlier, it would display with a 98.6% forward-looking statistical probability your max drawdown over any 12-month period. And then I started to think about that, and I said, I could get the client to sign off on that. And I don't know, Julie, if you saw the first iteration of RiskPro. I would call it the prototype. We didn't have a risk profiling questionnaire attached to it. You just simply walked in and typed in your max gain loss over any 12-month period, and it calculated from that. And the system would tell me, the advisor, how much beta, standard deviation, and so forth to put in it. And then, it, you know, it's loaded with the product shelf. And it was like, wow, this is like a virtual CFA on the spot. So it was kind of that, I'm not a big fan of the term, but it was kind of that aha moment. And I said, that needs to be on everybody's desktop. And that was the inception of RiskPro.
Yeah. And then there was the voila moment when the developers actually created RiskPro. And all the blood, sweat, and tears that it went into it, we'll just skip over that for now. Hey, now there's RiskPro. It can be on everyone's desktop.
Well, actually, the software industry is a whole different animal than the TAMP business or the client-facing advisory space. So yeah, so there were some blood, sweat, and tears there. But we took a unique path on that. And we went out and interviewed broker-dealers and heads of RIAs and did a bunch of market intel on figuring out what their biggest liabilities were that they didn't have solutions for. And first thing out of their mouth every time was rep as manager business is the one that keeps them up at night. And then I brought up to them, well, what about when the advisor assembles more than one model into the same account? Aren't they back in that role? And they said, 100%, we didn't even think of that. You know, they were thinking if the rep is selecting models, that the home office is okay, that they don't have that liability. And I questioned that, because the whole reason RiskPro came about, or at least half of the reason it came about, was because the reps were actually putting together models awkwardly in some cases.
Right. And I didn't ask you this, and I wanted to a couple of minutes ago, documentation, because I did an interview with Jenny Devlin. And Jeff did one with Chris Mills, and you could have a methodology, but if it's not documented, it's not there. So could you just touch on that for a second?
Yeah, well, I think actually I would say it a little bit differently, that in a digital risk system, you're absolutely documenting it. So you better have very sound math, right? Because you are leaving a virtual paper trail, so it better be right on the money. And that, you know, that would explain, Julie, I don't want to go down the rabbit hole, but that would explain why, at least in the early days, the due diligence process was such a long process, because all the managers had to do due diligence on the mathematics in the system. All the broker dealers and RIAs had to get their arms around it, understand it, and make sure that we weren't inventing math, so to speak. We were using generally accepted portfolio construction principles in our mathematics, and we passed the due diligence test every time. And I credit a lot of that to not just Josh Emanuel, but just for a belt and suspenders, Julie, we brought in a guy that was on the team that won a Nobel Prize in 2017, although we brought him in earlier than that. That was kind of a happy later achievement in the gentleman's career. But we brought in Professor Agnew, who's a PhD in math and physics, and had him, for lack of a better description, certify the math and write a white paper on it. And that actually sped up the due diligence process with the asset managers and the consuming broker dealers and RIAs.
All right. Nice. That's I just lost my train of thought, but I wanted to ask you something that went along with that. If I get it back, I'll ask you.
Is it 420 over there already?
Wait. That's only 350. All right. So do we want to talk perpetual suitability or no?
Yeah, I still got 30 minutes, Julie. Yeah, I think we do, because there's several different business models out there, right? And in the early days, I flirted with they call it SaaS, right? Software as a Service, SaaS. And that's where you go and you sign up, you know, one advisor at a time for a monthly stipend and give them a license to the software. And I looked at that and...
Like a seat fee.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Or a license fee or whatever. You know, think of our competitors, you know, they're selling it at the advisor level. And to me, that sales cycle was in those days, because the digital risk assessment tools were not fully adopted or accepted in the industry. What I wanted to do was I wanted to improve the advisor-client communications by introducing client accountability in the process. But I wanted to do it in a way that actually mitigated liability, and not only liability for the advisor, but I really wanted to mitigate the broker dealers and independent RIAs suitability liability, because as I said, when we did that market research, we knew that that was their largest unmitigated liability. So what we did is we designed and trademarked a system of perpetual suitability. And that's to say that, you know, an advisory, you know your customer, but we all still kind of call it suitability, right? I'll say it differently. In brokerage, it has to be suitable at the point of sale. And then it can drift away and sort of your risk can wander off up or down. In advisory, you're a fiduciary and you're getting paid a life of the asset annual fee, usually in basis points. You're expected to maintain that suitability. So what we did is we designed the system to take the holdings every night, run them back through the algorithm, and make sure that the account stays in an acceptable drift parameter. And there's a rules engine where the home office can set what is considered permissible drift. So when we did that, the broker dealers started adopting it firm-wide and then mandating its use. And I really have to cater to three layers, right? The broker dealer is my customer, or RIA, the financial advisor is a customer, and the end investor is a customer. And, you know, really wanted to leave a mark on this industry and fix something that I viewed as heavily broken. It just blew my mind, Julie, that in an industry this big, I mean, this is the epicenter of the global economy. This is the grease that makes the whole engine turn, the capital markets, right? And yet the best we had before RiskPro was you take a client through a risk profiling questionnaire and you score them into a risk profile like moderate.
Right. Archaic.
Okay. I asked my clients, what does that mean to you? You should have heard the varying answers. They were all over the map. Oh, middle of the road. Little of this, little of that. I mean, it was all over the place.
I've heard 60-40. I've heard everything for a moderate. Seriously.
Yeah. Well, let me just comment on that 60-40 business. The average 60-40 portfolio in Morningstar's database in 08 lost just over 30%. That was the average, I believe. Okay. I'm quoting 12 years ago, so bear with me. I'm a point or two in, you know, off. But if you think about that, the S&P only lost like 37.5, 38, something like that. Where was the protection on the 40? You know, You only lost 7 more points being all stock. Where was the protection? Well, what a lot of people didn't understand was it depends on what type of fixed income you're putting in the portfolio and whether there's residual equity beta or not. So the 60-40, you know, that simplicity is mythical to me. Okay, so the term moderate, right? The definition, it became very clear to me when I started sampling my clients. And I think that's another advantage, by the way, Julie, that we have at RiskPro is that we have Claremont Financial and 500 end investors that we get.
Yeah, you get real-time feedback from your brother Gator. You have your finger on the pulse of investor behavior and emotion.
I'm not just guessing from an ivory tower. Anyway, one cannot mitigate a liability if there is ambiguity and an element of misunderstanding. In other words, moderate. Okay, what you said, a little 60, a little 40, and then all of a sudden you have a crash and you only lose 7% less than the S&P itself. That's not mitigating your liability. That's creating it, in my opinion. So you cannot introduce client accountability if they don't understand everything, but they do understand how much can I lose. So when you convey it to them in dollars and then get them to sign for that, you've just removed all that ambiguity. So we wanted to get rid of all of that and clear this up and straighten the line of communication from the end investor to the advisor, to the home office, or to the portfolio manager, if it's somebody other than the advisor, then to the home office. So that even though they all speak in different terms, it's translated so that they're all saying the same thing in their own language.
Oh, we have a title. It's translated. This is the translator, right? And I urge anyone who hasn't read the story, Nick refers to this, Jeff does as well, his partner, as he uses this story of a UN translator. So the analogy is moderate to one person, obviously, isn't moderate to another person. If it's warm in Minnesota, it's probably 40 degrees. If it's 40 degrees in Newport Beach, it's chilly, right?
Because it really just distills down everything RiskPro does. It's a communication piece that monitors portfolios away from drift. And for advisors, it substantially improves their communication with their clients.
All right, I'm going to stop you because I'm going to either make this 2 podcasts or I'm going to make this a long one. But I have to get to this other stuff with you because you're such an interesting character. And I said at the beginning of this episode, I gave a little history on how I met you and like my take on your energy. And you're an intense person, right? And I know that at any point here, you could run.
Well, as long as the subject matter.
You got a lot to do. So I want to talk about you a little bit. Anyone who wants to learn more about RiskPro, I have a lot of things on the translator website, as well as Nick will actually talk to you. You know, call the number. We have a number to get you in touch with Nick, and he'll actually be more than happy to talk to you. He's down to earth. He's walked in your shoes if you're an advisor. He's worked with people at every level, big and small, and it really helps create the character that he is. It's authentic, and he is not going to mince words, let me say it that way. So, Nick, before we lose time, let's talk about your family. And you grew up in Southern California. And tell me about that lifestyle, I guess. I'm from Pennsylvania. I have no freaking idea what it's like to live in Southern California. And I would love to hear that from you because I think it makes, you know, a big part of you today.
Okay. I feel like I'm the only guy that is told he's intense that doesn't understand that he's intense. I have no idea, but I hear it. Anyway, so I'll go only as far back as high school. So in high school, we did nothing but loiter on the beach. That's all we did. We skimboarded, we surfed, we wore probably had 2 board shorts that we switched in and out of all summer long. I don't remember wearing t-shirts. And true to the Italian definition of my name, which means barefoot, I never had shoes on, obviously, until school came. But I remember reading a book on Warren Buffett in 1985 when I was 16. And I didn't really know what all the terms meant, like price to earnings and intrinsic value and all those words he uses in those books. But it hit me that I just used the term earlier. It was the epicenter of the global economy, and I want to be in that game. I would run in and ask my parents what that stuff meant, and they'd give me the answer, and I'd run back and keep reading the book. But then And this is before Buffett was a household name anywhere. And I actually didn't believe the title of the book or somewhere on the book cover. It might have been like the subtitle, but I remember it vividly. It said, the first person to make $1 billion from investing alone or solely from investing, something like that. And that intrigued me. And then I was going to Cal State Fullerton and I had aced every single exam in economics. And I saw that I got a C on the report card. And that had a financial impact given my dad's formula, which I still can't figure out. And I was a math.
What a good dad.
Okay. I think he just moved wherever he wanted it to go because I never could accomplish it even when I accomplished it. So anyway, when I got the C, I went and called the professor, not intensely. I started out not intense, at least. And I said, hey, what gives here? I got all these exams that have A's on. He said, you were only in my class 5 days this semester. There's no way you aced my course without cheating. You're lucky I didn't give you an F, you know, something to that effect. And I said, that's it. I'm out. And
so you gave him an F and split town.
I gave him an F. Yeah. So I left and I got a job cold calling at a broker dealer. Back in those days, they were called brokers. And
do you mean like a wirehouse?
No, it wasn't a wirehouse. I didn't qualify for a wirehouse because I left early. So, you know, there are consequences to your actions. Okay. Anyway, I'm kind of, you know, I wouldn't change it. I wouldn't go back and change it. So I started doing pretty well because I hustle. And 6 months later, my oldest brother joined me. And his first month, and this is 1991 or two, okay? His first month as a licensed advisor, he made like $160,000. And that's when we knew this was it. So we ended up working together for a while, a long while. And then later on, about 3 years later, our middle brother joined us. And he's the gentleman that is running our client-facing RIA. Unfortunately, my oldest brother passed away in 2010 from a thyroid cancer, which is still a bummer.
Oh, wow.
So there were two, and that's how we got in the business. And then we converted to fee-based advisory, which was, I think, on the, you know, not the bleeding edge of the movement, but certainly the cutting edge. And then that led to the TAMP business, then the fund business, because we had funds there too, Julie, and then the software business.
All right. So tell us quickly how you took that leap of, you know, you started the business with your brothers. Your one brother unfortunately passed. You and your other brother were doing very well in the business. How did you meet Megan? Because that's the million-dollar question here.
I happened to be surfing in Fiji, and I was in the, it was a catamaran. I was in the bottom of the boat, and I had a email reception, and I got an email from a very lovely lady who has become one of my best friends of all time, and I have mad respect for her, Megan Mead from the Pacific Financial. And she emailed me and said, I hear you're the risk guy. I need to talk.
That sounds like Megan. Just get to the point, right?
Well, it turns out, actually, there was a financial advisor using RiskPro. He had adopted it completely throughout his business. And he was at one of Megan Mead's, you know, Pacific Financial conferences. And Megan had given a presentation and said, any questions? And the gentleman raised his hand and he said, what keeps you up at night? And she said, well, I, as you know, because these were all producers for her in the room, she said, as you folks know, I've tried to implement this risk system, which is a competitor to RiskPro. She said, we've gone back and forth for 18 months. It's cost me a lot of money, but I have to tear it out of the system because the math is broken. And we can't get it to work with normal, acceptable portfolio mathematics. And he said, have you spoken to Nick Scalzo? He can solve your problem. And what a compliment, right? I mean, that was awesome when one of your customers will say that about you. So she sent the email and then we had a 15 minutes call on the calendar that lasted 2.5 hours. I was in Bellevue, Washington, 3 days after the call. And we built her a custom Risk Pro that worked, but not enterprise grade, just to prove the math. We had built that for her in about 6 to 8 weeks. And it was interesting too, Julie, because at the same time, I had done a deal with BNY Mellon through Pershing to adopt Risk Pro and make it available to the 100,000 advisors over there. But they have a very interesting, let's call it a queue. I think of it more as a padded cell. Anyway, they don't tell you how long you're going to be in that padded cell. And then one day they say, we're turning you on in 3 weeks. Well, the interesting thing is you need to staff up for that. But if you do that, when they don't tell you how long you're going to be in there.
Right. You end up having too much overhead waiting to get turned on to 100,000 possible users. And that's a dangerous situation, obviously.
Yeah. So I turned to Megan and I said, hey, I need some advice, one CEO to another. And she said, what is this? Well, I'm going live on this deal to up to 100,000 advisors in like 3 weeks all of a sudden. And I'm pretty sure I don't have the infrastructure built out for that. Now, what would you do? Now, of course, Julie, I was chumming the water here, seeing if she would take the bait and was interested in partnering with me. But I asked her what she would do. Would you go get venture or private equity money? What would you do? And she said, I would merge and pick me.
That's so Megan.
And so we did. And we merged.
I love that story.
Yeah. Well, because it's true. And then it has a good outcome and a good ending. Well, we're not at the end yet, but it's been really fun this far along. So then we closed the merger in September of 2017. And now when you combine all the businesses, we have the technology, we have 15 mutual funds, two RIAs, and over $3.1 billion in assets under management based on the last time I looked. So it's been a good, fun ride.
I'm so glad that Megan found you and replaced what we were trying to make work before with some actual math. She's an amazing person, as you know, and I have her targeted to be a guest on my podcast. In the meantime, I have one more question for you, and I don't think we can let you go until I dig into this with you. So, because you are a drummer in a punk band, and because you grew up in the 80s in Southern California. Now, you know how much I love music, but I don't know too much about punk, right? So I know like Dead Kennedys, the Ramones, the Misfits, Clash, Iggy Pop, but I don't really know anything about and didn't know anything about what sort of role that Southern California played when it came to punk music. I mean, I thought of the UK, maybe more so than I did the United States. I didn't know about the Adolescence before I met you. So I think it'd be really cool if you could let our listeners hear what it is, what's different about punk music. And I know there's all different types of punk music. If you could tell us what it's like being in a punk band in Southern California and give us some of your favorites.
Oh, it was kind of scary, but, you know, interesting. It all happened when I was in fifth grade. That's when everything hit the scene. And so at that age, it was a little bit intimidating, but it captivated nearly everybody in Orange County. Like Orange County had its own sort of microcosm punk. Like, you know, people still call it original Orange County punk. Some of the bands that you mentioned were from overseas or back east with the Ramones, CBGB stuff. We had homegrown bands like the Adolescents, TSOL, which stands for True Sounds of Liberty. We had Black Flag and some other names that I probably not supposed to put on the air here. And as little kids, we were captivated by it. We were kind of done with I don't know if we were ever not done with disco, but we were ready to move on. And when this came, it was energetic. It was a bit angry. You know, maybe that has something to do with the intensity we talked about earlier, but it really hit you. It wasn't super melodic. You know, some of it, when I go back and listen to it now, some of it just is not doing for me what it used to do. Interestingly, I actually became friends with a lot of those guys in my adult life and thought of them as heroes or famous people in my youth. For example, I'm in a band now called The Professor and the Madman. I'm the drummer for them in North America. Rat Scabies from the Damned is their drummer when they're in Europe. And one of the guys in the band was one of the original members of the Adolescents. Conversely, well, conversely is the wrong word, but at the same time, I met Jack Grisham, the frontman for TSOL, and he comes into my music room, and we both have agreed we're going to record some very, a lot lighter stuff. Like the, he, when he plays live, Jack Grisham of TSOL, he, they're still playing their TSOL punk stuff from, you know, 1979 or whatever. But all of those guys love all kinds of music, and everybody wants to kind of write more melodic stuff out of our Rispro offices. We have a music room there, and these guys will come in. And ultimately, my vision for that is Orange County Songwriters Coalition. So the guys from the band Sugar Ray collaborated with me on the idea, and these guys are going to come in and write a bunch of songs. We just got to get past COVID to get the thing off the ground.
Yeah, it's kind of tough to get a lot of guys together in a room and actually sing through a mask and socially distance. Oh, well, hopefully that'll be all behind us soon. And I think what I'll try to do is end this episode with some hardcore punk, hopefully.
Can I pick the Sex Pistols? The song my mom walked in our bedroom when we were kids and grabbed the album and threw it away. That one. That's how punk was received by our parents back in those days. If they found it, they destroyed it.
I had a very, very similar situation growing up where I had some music destroyed by some conservative parents. God love them.
Yep. We came out all right, didn't we, kid? You know, I actually had a lot more fun doing this, Julie, than I had anticipated. I was a little nervous, you know, coming in here and talking about me or whatever, but you made it really fun. This was awesome. I'd love to come back.
Yahoo, let's do it. Bring that good friend of yours, Megan Mead, with you. I think due to copywriting, we're going to choose the Professor and the Madman, Chupacabra Man, to spin us out of here. All right, have a good one, Nick.
Have a great day.
If you would like to have some of your firm's accounts tested by RiskPro's algorithm or see a live demo, please click on our link in the Translator website or visit us at riskproadvisor.com to see how adding RiskPro to your tech stack can have a huge positive impact on your business. This recording has been prepared and made available by RiskPro to be used for informational purposes only. RiskPro is an investment risk profiling and portfolio construction software as a service platform developed by ProTools LLC. The information contained herein, including any expressions of opinion, has been obtained from or is based on sources believed to be reliable, but its accuracy or completeness is not guaranteed and is subject to change without notice. Any expressions of opinions reflect the views of the speakers and are not necessarily those of ProTools or its affiliates. ProTools does not provide investment, legal, or tax advice. Investors should consult their financial, tax, or legal professionals before investing. Any third parties mentioned in the podcast have no affiliation with the Pacific Financial Group, Inc., or ProTools. Have a nice day.